This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to the penultimate episode of Stage 9, a show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today, you know, we're going to take a look at Star Trek Discovery because it just ended, you know, as far as season one is concerned. And we started off this series with a look at all the people who are on the writing staff. And, you know, we're going to come full circle now that we've seen it. What do we think about it? What's the end result of the past couple of years of, I don't know, speculation and trying to piece together what certain pairings or groupings mean to this show, and how do we feel about the end result? Because when we started this, I think we were very excited about the pieces which were in place.
Yes, I completely agree. Yes, we were excited about everything that was on the horizon.
Yes, remember? Yes. The future certainly looked bright for Star Trek Discovery. And this was back before, well, anything happened. Brian Fuller was still involved and all that good stuff. And yeah, the end result, I think, is very different from where it was when we started this show. So I guess the first question is, well, as of recording this, it just ended yesterday. So we both just watched it, you know, mere hours ago. What do you think?
It was good. I enjoyed it. It wasn't great. And there were some decisions that I kind of scratched my head over. You know, it's entertaining. And I don't come out of it, you know, pumping the fist in the air like the end of the Breakfast Club. Like, yeah, Star Trek's back. I came out of it like, that's a good, it's a good show. It's a good show. How did you end up overall?
I like it a lot. You know, I talked about this a little bit on Tracks from the Edge a couple days ago, but it really is sort of like a modern take on Star Trek, and in a way that Star Trek has never been. And I don't mean that it's, you know, like Star Trek has never been before, because we haven't been at this point yet, but I mean, like, Star Trek has always sort of been slightly behind the curve in terms of its production and everything like that. It's not a franchise which is exactly known for taking chances with its visual storytelling, or with its, you know, as much as people like to give Deep Space Nine credit for being the first show with, like, a continuing mythology, that is a bunch of nonsense. Because I remember when Deep Space Nine was on and, you know, trying to fit it into that box, which it did not fit into. And there were other shows on, other sci-fi shows, other shows set on space stations, which were doing a better job of that than Deep Space Nine was. So, you know, but it was more serialized than any Star Trek had been, but it wasn't exactly, you know, I mean, we're not talking, you know, NYPD Blue here. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, no, I agree with what you're saying about it. Not Deep Space Nine is, you know, I still consider it gold standard and everything, and I'm not taking anything away from that. I'm agreeing with you that, to your point, it's not exactly NYPD Blue. There wasn't something like, wow, I when you say that, now I'm like, now I'm thinking back, I'm like, or Twin Peaks. Like Twin Peaks was something that like was like, hello, television format, kablam, I'm gonna blow this whole thing up. This is the first time that I think that Trek has approached that sort of intestinal fortitude, sort of thing.
Kind of that continuing storyline sort of thing, you know, hardcore, where it's like, you know, this is one big story. I mean, they tried, you know, I mean, the later seasons of Deep Space Nine sort of had that idea. But even like season 7, you know, has Take Me Out to the Holosuite and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Enterprise season 3, I guess the case could be made that that did it. But, it, you know, you had individual episodes in there, it, you know, where you do here too. But, you know, they feel a bit more tied in. Like even in those standalone episodes, there are things which carry over to the next, you mm-hmm. know. Whereas you could pretty much take out, you know, North Star or whatever. Whatever from season 3 of Enterprise, I don't know, and it wouldn't really matter, but I mean, because of that, like the deck is stacked in Discovery's favor, in my sort of like estimation, because this is the type of storytelling that I'm looking for out of TV. You know, not to say that I don't like other Star Trek shows, but certainly like. You know, one of the things which I kind of was really, really looking forward to going into this show more than what the show was about was how it was going to be told. Mm. And I really did like the way it was told, you know?
Yeah, I'll agree that the way it was told was oftentimes its strongest attribute. I think there were... I don't know if this is myself, you know, just sort of like reading into it. This is sort of the curse of knowing so much behind the scenes stuff. But I always find myself sitting there wondering when I watch certain things, saying, am I seeing a sign of the change in direction? Am I seeing, can I pick out what is Fuller's DNA in this moment and what is them coming in and redoing it? And so I think that a lot of times that... that extra textual knowledge, like it's not just about reading Kemp Powers's play or seeing a movie that somebody else worked on or produced or a series or something like that. It's about the nature of this show itself. And I think that there are aspects of it that, like Vok, you know, where does this one end and this other one begin? And what is its true nature? I mean, if anything, I'd say that Ash Tyler's internal storyline is almost a metaphor for the entire series up to this point of what exactly is it? What is its true nature and where is it coming from and where is it going?
Yeah. It's caught between two worlds. Yeah, I can see that. And it is interesting because, you know, little drips and drabs have come out, you know, since this thing has been on the air in terms of like, what was there from the beginning, what was added later and everything like that. I mean, the big one, which I think is interesting, is that the mirror universe was always intended to be a part of the show and that in the initial conception, they were going to go to the mirror universe in episode 4 instead of episode 10. And the reason why they moved it back is because, you know, according to, you know, Gretchen Berg, I think, you know, she said, like, if you go to the mirror universe and encounter the mirror versions of these characters that we just met, it doesn't really mean anything compared to later on when, after we've known them for a while, then we can see, you know, the dark reflection, you know, which I definitely see. You know.
I can see that. I can also see the argument where you could counter and say, well, what better way to tease out very quickly the true nature of these characters than by putting them up against the opposites of themselves so that you can immediately draw the distinction and say, yes, you're just getting to know these characters, but here's an opposite and here's the person you know is the prime person interacting with that opposite. And I think that maybe that's an idea that comes into play with the thought that, you know, people are used to things being thrown at them very quickly. What faster way can you possibly communicate about a character than throwing their antithesis up against them? And mm-hmm. it starkly outlines them. Who knows if they could have pulled... I'm not sitting here saying, oh, it's a better series if they did that. I'm just saying I could see the storytelling potential for it being a... like hitting the gas pedal to communicate the nature of a character to someone. Although, I mean, I guess you wind, I mean, you wind up blowing the whole Vok Tyler thing awfully quickly then. You know, although you could argue that a lot of people figured it out well before the big reveal, so.
Well, I wonder, because, like, I mean, who knows how differently the entire thing was structured, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could go to the Mirror Universe and you figure, well, okay, Lorca is going to be there, but how long do they spend there, you know? Also, you got to keep in mind that originally it was going to be 13 episodes instead of 15. So, you know, yeah. How did that break down? I don't know. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, I guess that sort of lends more. I don't know. I mean, because so it went from 13 to 15, which happened after Fuller left, and which is interesting in that, you know, in interviews that Fuller was giving and stuff like that. He was saying that he didn't want more. He wanted less. He thought that like 8 to 10 or something like that was a good length for a television season without any extra fat, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the idea that, well, I mean, like when I first heard that they had extended it to 15 episodes, I was like, okay, well, it's cool. They were getting 2 more hours of Star Trek, but seems to be counter to what, you know, the creator of the show wanted. You know, are we, you know, it almost felt like, okay, so we're going to get like extra nothing in a sense, you know?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, Fuller's thinking, you know, with that sort of statement is exactly in line with what we're used to getting now with the Netflix shows, with the Marvel shows and stuff like that, is 8 to 10 episodes a season. Punisher just came out and it was 13 episodes, and that was weird because I saw 13 episodes like in the queue and I was like, wow, that's I didn't realize how much I'd gotten used to less than 13. And it's still, you know, being old enough to remember 24 and 27 episode seasons of things, it's still mind-numbing to sit there and have this conversation of, oh, well, I could see 8 to 10. Well, 15 is, well, you know, you're really getting out there. It's like people used to, it's a really different TV landscape now.
And from what I've heard, I mean, the criticism, which I've seen multiple times of Punisher, is like, this is a really great 6-part season spread out over 13 parts, you know?
I would disagree with that assessment, but maybe Discovery can be credited with increasing my tolerance or patience for number of episodes or something. I don't know.
Okay. I mean, with Discovery, because, I mean, this is my big question. Like, I mean, obviously things were, you know, moved around a little bit or whatever, but, like, is this basically the storyline that they had, you know, from the beginning, and they just kind of, like, broke down the beats differently in order to spread it out over 15? Or do they have like 13 episodes locked in and they were like, okay, we need to add 2 more now. What are they going to be? And I mean, I'm sure there's no simple answer to that, but I kind of think that they added 2 after the fact. And I think that the 2 they added were Lethe and Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, or whatever it's called, because those 2 really do feel like just standalone out there sort of things, you know?
I agree. And this is speaking of someone where I think Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad is one of, for me, the highlights of the season, because I thought that was just a really clever show, really well paced, really well directed, really well edited. I liked a whole lot about that episode. And I'd say that's probably the point at which the series engaged me most before the ending, was that episode. And so I suppose you could make the argument that maybe that is a testament to the idea that maybe a tighter focus would have made more of these episodes that.
See, like, I'm really conflicted on that, because, like, when that episode came out, I was like, this is the best episode so far, you know? And I still think it's the best episode up until that point. I think there have been better episodes since, but I do think it was the best episode up until that point. And it's a lot of fun and everything, but at the same time, even then, even after watching it and saying, this is the best episode so far, I was like, and the show would be better if it wasn't there. You know, the series on the whole would be better if you didn't have that episode in the you know.
See, it's so interesting, because I had, a variation of that reaction actually with the second episode of the series overall. I thought that they could have told that, you know, the Battle of the Binary Stars faster and then saved certain parts of it for revelatory flashback later in the season. So my mind goes to, was that the plan, to tease out the revelations as they went along, as opposed to having this essentially split up self-contained TV movie sitting out there?
I suppose that is a possibility. I tend to think not. I tend to think that that was originally supposed to be the way it is now. Just because I think, you know, they had always from the beginning said that it was going to open up with like a 2-hour thing. And, you know, that really does sort of, you know, make for its own little movie, you know, like you're saying. So I kind of think that that's not the case, but I don't know. I mean, also like speaking like, okay, so we both liked magic to make the sanest man go mad, but like Lethe, like I think that that's probably the worst episode of the series, right? I mean, I don't know if I know a lot of people don't like the Saru episode. That's probably the least favorite among fans.
I think the biggest issue with the Saru episode was that that too could have been quicker. That could have been shorter and attacked onto another episode sort of thing. And I think that one of the pacing issues for me was that there were certain moments where they went the biggest complaint I remember about Voyager was that they would have these really engaging A plots and then this B plot that was consumed with technobabble. And there were definitely a couple of moments where I can't remember the episode titles as well as you can, but
I can't remember most of them myself.
Whichever one it was where they had to reseed the planet, you know, because we'll grow more spores and stuff like that. It was like, it just felt like they went somewhere and were, how are we going to get out of this? Throw a bunch of terminology that doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense, but sounds sciencey, and we'll do that. And, you know, you're a Star Trek fan, so you're kind of like, yeah, okay, I know how this works.
Yeah, that episode was just like exposition central or whatever, you know? Yeah. I mean, that there was like, and that's the episode where like literally nothing happens. And yeah. And my big complaint with that one is like, yeah, it's like, okay, well, yeah, we need to figure out how to get back to this point. Okay, well, let's just make this thing up. But then the other thing, just sort of on a larger scale, I thought it was like the whole episode was kind of designed as a way of explaining why we haven't heard about their mirror universe adventures in the original series, you know?
Like,
we can't tell anyone about this. Like, I thought that that was kind of weird, too, you know? But
you know, and it makes me think of there's a Simpsons episode very, very long time ago where, and it was actually Martin Sheen did the voice. You find out that Principal Skinner isn't the real Seymour Skinner, and the real Seymour Skinner shows up and throws everything into chaos and all of that stuff. And at the end, everybody's had it with the real Seymour Skinner, and they're shipping him off tied up to a chair on top of a train. And the judge says, "Let no one speak of this again on pain of torture." It's sort of that sort of moment.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but what can you do? I mean, the fact that, in my mind, you know, this show went for, you know, 15 episodes and had only a couple, which I was like, oh, that's okay. You know, I mean, that's pretty. There were basically three where I was like, eh, it's fine. And the others, I was like, this is really solid, you know?
I had a harder time connecting to it than you did. I really did, and it doesn't have anything to do with canon or production value or looking like the old series. That's not my bag at all. For me, it gets back to the whole thing of I just wasn't sure what this show was most of the time. You know, I go back to the Vok and Tyler thing of making it, in a sense, unnecessarily complicated for how he got to be who he was when we saw him sort of thing was just a really, it seemed like a really convoluted way to say, well, we know they can change themselves to look like humans, so let's do this, but it's really that, and he's still both of them, but not really, and It came across as too complicated. And I think that is, maybe that speaks to the 15 episodes. Maybe they saw that it was too much to cram into the 8 to 10 or 13. And they said, we might hit some slow points, but we really need more time just to let this breathe with people to think it through. But it was an odd experience, not because I disliked it, but because I think that overall you wind up with a series that's about Star Trek as opposed to really being about anything else. I know that there are allegories. I know that there are, you know, you can't let fear win. Oh, there are obvious allegories to you can't become the monster to defeat the enemy without, you know, the war without, the war within, those sorts of things. But overall, I just came away with the sense that this show is really just about Star Trek overall.
Yeah, I didn't really get that vibe, you know. Like, I would almost make that argument for like the JJ movies, which I'm okay with. You know, I mean, I love those movies. I still think that's the best that Star Trek's ever been. But I mean, I really do feel like this show was kind of a reflection of our time. And does that thing that Star Trek does, you know, where it comments on, you know, what's going on in the world today. And I think that it does it rather effectively. And I guess I like what it has to say. But
I said, there are the moments in there where, you know, that they're very obviously making a statement about something that we as an audience know is going on in the real world. But there were still, I don't know, it just didn't connect on that level with me overall, consistently, I should say. It didn't connect with me. Like, there were the moments where I could see that coming through were probably the moments where I was most engaged, where I was like, okay, this is thought-provoking, and I'm thinking about now and thinking about it in this context and with a metaphor. But it just, I don't know, it just wasn't a consistent connection for me.
Okay, all right. I don't know. That part did work for me, I have to say. There were some mechanics which kind of didn't work, but on the whole, I really did like it. But we'll get back to that in our final thoughts. So, okay, you know, we've been talking about the people who are making this show since the very beginning of this show, and, you know, there was a lot of anticipation on our parts, you know, because of that. And, you know, now here's our chance to kind of like follow through on that. You know, what is it that we saw? You know, what is it that we liked or didn't like, or what, you know, what surprised us or disappointed us or whatever. So just have a few questions, and we can apply these to, you know, like, let's say a writer and a director for each of these. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with the first one. You know, we looked at a lot of the work of these creative people working on this show in order to sort of get a handle on who they were, who it was who was making this show. And, you know, we discovered a lot of stuff which I think we normally wouldn't have been exposed to. So I guess my first question is, which outside work that we looked at through this series were you most impressed by? First for writer.
Well, again, not taking anything away from any of the other very talented people that we looked at, I'm always going to go back to One Night in Miami by Kent Powers. That is the high watermark for me, because that was just I thought it was just a joyous experience to discover that.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the type of thing where I never would have been exposed to it in a million years if it weren't for the fact that he was working on this show, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just kind of this hidden gem which is out there, which, you know, we found, and it's pretty awesome. You know, for those people who may not remember, maybe didn't listen, this is a play which was written by Kent Powers, who wrote Choose Your Pain, and it's about the night that Muhammad Ali won the world championship. He was in Miami, hence the title, One Night in Miami. Yes. And after he won, he went back to his hotel room, and it was him, Malcolm X, James Brown, and Sam Cooke. and the four of them were just in a hotel room. And this play speculates on what may have happened in that room, what the conversation was like. So, you know, it's playing, it has played, you know, around the world, and apparently, you know, there's hopes that it will get a much wider release, or whatever you want to call it. I don't know.
Yeah.
In the coming years or months or whatever. But in the meantime, if you want to read it, you can get it on Amazon for the Kindle or whatever. Well worth it. I think we would both agree.
Yes. Highly, highly recommended. Yeah.
So what about for directors? Was there anything that you saw that impressed you that maybe you hadn't seen before?
I've actually been thinking about this, and I don't know that there's anything that really, you know, knocked
it's
my
hard
socks
because
off
there were so
the
many
way.
People you know, who there thought, are, you know, like,
yeah.
There was all the Vincenzo Natali stuff.
That's, you know, true. Yeah, wait a minute.
And then there was Man in the High Castle. And,
yeah. You know. Jeez. I mean, the thing is, if we can count him, then yeah, I thought that, you know, I thought Cube was pretty great. But you're right. There was so much stuff that we watched that wound up, the person wound up leaving the show.
Yep. It's definitely true.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. What about you?
You know, it's hard, you know, because a lot of the stuff, like, I had already seen, you know? I mean, whether it's Highlander Endgame or Nurse or whatever, you know, like, those things I had seen already. But, you know, they were still a joy to watch. But I think the thing which maybe I rediscovered because it had been a long time and like, I knew how much I loved it, which is why I was so excited to get back to it. But watching it again, it just blew me away like it had before. It's that first season finale of Dawson's Creek, which was directed by David Semel, who did The Vulcan Hello. That, I don't know.
Now, see, I guess that's the problem, is I didn't go back and watch the season one finale of Dawson's Creek. Maybe that was my misstep.
You should. It's so well done. Highly, highly, highly recommended. And the reason why I was super excited about Semel directing the pilot. So, yeah. Okay. Well, moving on. In terms of like the show itself, what writer impressed you the most with what you saw? You know, I mean, you can take that however you want, whether like, who wrote the best episode, who was the biggest surprise for you. I mean, whatever, however you want to interpret that.
I mean, I would go to Choose Your Pain. I thought that was an incredibly well-written episode. And, you know, and I wind up going back to Kemp Powers for that. I thought it was really well-directed, too. And I got to tell you that, especially because the guy, I think, gets such an unfair rap. I mean, we've sort of come to the conclusion that the guy gets an unfair rap. But Akiva Goldsman, I thought that the direction on the final episode, on the finale. Now, this is, you know, I had issues with certain things they did in the finale. But I thought overall, it was a real treat. Bergen Harberts wrote the finale, the final episode, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Goldsman wrote the story for it with him, which is really interesting, you know, because we kind of speculated like, oh, it looks like his role on this may be similar to his role on like Fringe, you know? Yeah. I mean, if you look at Fringe, like he like wrote and directed and was involved with basically the premieres and the finales of like every season, you know, and sort of like anytime there was like a broad stroke on that show, he had a hand in it. But he wasn't, at least it didn't seem like, there on like a daily basis, you know, sort of like doing the sort of everyday grunt work. But
yeah,
he was sort of like the, and it seems like it's kind of the same thing here. You know, he wrote the premiere, directed episode 3, and then he directs the finale. And, you know, those are like 3 like key episodes. And
yeah,
it's just interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, especially because the third episode, I remember everybody's reaction was, well, this feels like its own pilot. Like it felt like a restart, you know, just 3 episodes into the season. But I really, I mean, it's hard for me to separate the writing and direction of the finale, specifically because I thought that direction-wise, the way that it was, the way that the world was realized that they were in was, I think, unquestionably the most authentic world-building experience I think I've had in Star Trek in a very long time. And I think that undeniably part of that is the writing, because you have the characters and the setups all worked out at that point. But then you have to pair that with a director who is going to bring this, you know, sense of reality infused into it. Like, it was the first time, I think, and this isn't like necessarily knocking anything, but this is the first time where, for instance, I see Paris of the future and I look at it and I say that, wow, I buy that. That looks the way I think it would probably look in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, there was none of this sort of having to force myself to accept, well, okay, I could see how this would go. Like, I looked at it and I said, oh okay. That looks pretty legit for the way it would work.
Yeah, not to mention the back streets of Kronos or whatever.
No, the back streets of Kronos are specifically, I mean, just phenomenal. I can't recall seeing anything in Star Trek up to this point that had such a feeling of authenticity in terms of the construction of a planet that they went to and a different culture that they went to. And it felt so real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. And, you know, just also like just in terms of like the photography and stuff in that episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the stuff early on up in the ship, the establishing shot and everything at the beginning of the episode and everything is like so cool. And it really just sort of like brings it home visually as well, which is cool because that, like you're saying, that's something that Goldsman is known for. He's known much more as a writer. So it's cool to see him get to exercise these talents as well, for sure. I mean, yeah. You could say is he a better director than he is a writer? I don't know. He does have an Oscar for writing, you know. People forget that, but
he does. He has written some good stuff. I mean, we talked about that. Like, everybody gets so hung up on the Batman stuff. It's just like he's done other things. It's so funny. That's just the scarlet letter that walks around with him, but it's a B instead of an A. So
it's a
bat
symbol, the scarlet bat.
the scarlet bat. That's right. Yeah. But I mean, just in terms of writing, those are the two episodes that just that pop out to me. That's not to say that there weren't well written episodes elsewhere in the season, but those were the two that really really clicked for me.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I guess like as far as the writing is concerned, well, writing and direction, it comes down to the same episode, which is Into the Forest I Go, which is the finale of chapter one, where they're doing all the jumps around the Klingon ship, and then they end up destroying it and all that stuff, and then at the end they go to the Mirror Universe. That episode, to me, is easily the best of the entire series, but I was incredibly impressed by both the writing and the direction. And they were both by, you know, people who we were not overly familiar with. I mean, in terms of the writing, it was, you know, Bo-Young Kim and Erica Lapolte, who, you know, we talked about, you know, having worked on Rain. And also we read those short stories that they wrote for that book. But still, it's just like, that's crazy. Hey, you know? And then you watch this and it's like so tightly constructed and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, it was just kind of great seeing this. And, you know, going into it, there were a lot of people who were like, you know, this episode's fantastic. You know, watch out for this one. You know, Ted Sullivan, one of the producers and writers, said ahead of time, like, this is the best one of the series, you know, all that stuff. And then it comes out and it was just mind-blowingly good, you know, and the writing had a big part in that. But another, you know, aspect which I think you gotta, you know, give credit for is the direction in that episode by Chris Byrne. I mean, I said this at the time, I stand by it. I think as far as television episodes are concerned, I think it may be the single best directed episode of Star Trek in history. It just blew me away. I was watching it again over the weekend, and I'm just like, like that whole jump sequence, I'm just like, this is so perfectly constructed. It's amazing. You know, the shot selection, the angles and movements, which we've never seen before in Star Trek, all in service of the story. The editing was like spot on. I mean, I don't know. It just, it gives me chills just thinking about it, you know? And that's a dude who essentially hasn't directed anything. I mean, aside from like, you know, second unit stuff and whatever, and like little projects here and there, which no one's seen, you know? And oh, I love it. Anyway.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a really good episode. You're making me want to go back and rewatch it just to, I mean, I the part of it that definitely does jump out to me is the part you were just talking about the jump sequence, about popping around and, you know, and basically scoring the big victory. It does stand out. It is really great. The episode as a whole, yeah, I mean, you know, it is well written. So, yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll go back and rewatch that. But
yeah, check it out. The, definitely the highlight of the season for me.
But that was certainly, I mean, the thing is, like, we haven't really talked about Discovery too much outside of this conversation, but like, what did you think of going to the Mirror Universe as a whole? Did you think they were there the right amount of time? You know, like, this is, sounds like one of those terrible surveys. Were they in the Mirror Universe too long? Not enough time. Just the right amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know that there's a lot of people who hate the Mirror Universe, a lot of people who think it's a crutch or whatever, or just a cheap gimmick. And, you know, aside from Mirror, Mirror, anytime you go to the Mirror Universe, it's just garbage. I am not one of those people. I love the Mirror Universe. I've loved it ever since I saw Mirror, Mirror as a kid. Every episode of Deep Space Nine, I've absolutely loved. I think In a Mirror Darkly is the best episode of Enterprise. I can't get enough of the Mirror Universe. And seeing it here, I really enjoyed it as well, because for one thing, it's got all of the, you know, your cliche Mirror Universe tricks, which are always a lot of fun. I mean, the stuff with Captain Killy and all that stuff is great.
Yeah.
But I also think that it really does sort of tie into the thematics of the show and, you know, sort of like what they're doing in terms of commenting on today's society and everything like that, and really sort of pushing the idea of like, hey guys, maybe we're living in the Mirror Universe. Maybe yeah. We should try to change that, you know, which is obviously what Star Trek is always doing, right? It's always commenting on today. And I think that the parallels that they draw to today's world are shocking, shockingly. I mean, and you know, it shouldn't be, but I love it. I love it.
Let me throw this at you, though, because with, you know, the very first Mirror Universe episode, Mirror, Mirror, leaving one changed Spock in the timeline was enough to change history for the weirder for the Mirror Universe until we met up again with it in Deep Space Nine. Well, we have, you know, evil Philippa on the loose now. So they've taken one character from the alternate universe and dropped her loose in ours. Well, if we go with Star Trek reasoning, doesn't that mean that she's going to change the, like, shouldn't they have just dropped her as soon as she tried to blow up Kronos? Shouldn't they have been like, oh, no. This is like that's one of the things I think that for all of the innovation and things that you could heap praise on for Discovery is having too many moments that were, I don't know, like that were the way they're supposed to go. Like I struggle for the wording, but let me give you an example. Have you ever seen the show? And forgive me if I've asked you this before. The Venture Brothers.
I've seen like maybe the one cartoon. Or two episodes.
There's a character in there voiced by Putty from Seinfeld. I forget his name right now. But anyway, he's great. Brock Sampson. He's like this unstoppable killing machine, right? And he encounters one of the villains at one point in an episode. And the guy's, you know, if circumstances were different, I think that maybe he's like, yeah, I've gotten this whole we could have been friends in a different life thing. Can we just skip this part? And there are moments like that in Discovery for me, and it, specifically in the finale of, if you're going to kill me, then go ahead and kill me, but you can't kill me because, I mean, honestly, the only reason that Philippa can't kill Michael in that scene is because you can't kill Michael in that scene. Like, when you have these situations, you always know you're going to get the speech about, I refuse to, you know, beam in and just shoot you in the back the way that I should because you're about to destroy an entire planet. You know, like, it's, yeah, there are just these moments that, I don't know, I guess too expected is the way I would put it, for everything else that they tried different.
I guess I kind of see what you're saying, but I also feel like, well, in that specific instance, Philippa doesn't really care. I get that impression throughout the entire episode, you know, is that she is there, and yes, she would ideally like to launch this thing and basically, you know, sort of grasp some control over both the Klingons and the Federation. But the reality of the situation is she's, you know, basically found a, I don't know if it's a way out or what, but she's got zero responsibility. She's got zero prospects, and she's just there to have a good time now, you know? And I think we see that throughout the episode. And when it gets to the end there, I mean, one of the things that I love about that is, like, you know, for one thing, the whole thing is resolved through talking instead of fighting, which I think is kind of a cool way to end a war, you know, and also speaks to the thematics or whatever. But also, you know, Burnham, she's like, look, I was important to you in the other universe. You were sad when I died. You would have to live with this image of killing me here. I don't think you want to do that, but also you'll be on the run forever. And her reaction is not like, oh God, I can't do that. You're right. You're right. That would just be too much for me to live with. She's like, oh, fine, whatever. Okay, yeah, you're right. This is way too much work. I am going to be on the run. You know, that is an image I wouldn't want to live with. And I could really go either way on this. So I'm just going to go with not killing you. Like, I mean, that's really like her reaction. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I don't really care. You know,
but it, if you're going to have the talking, I just think that there are any of a number of things where you could have had that sort of talky resolution or what have you without it being there or like that, or what is it? I don't know, but it just, you know, it just, you know, the talking with Laurel thing, I guess this is the only way to give Laurel the thing that she needs to start uniting the Klingon Empire. You know, I guess that's what you need to do. Although, again, you know, it just, it gets to magic device given to somebody and resolved. You know,
that one's like, a little weaker, you know, because, I mean, there are some logistics there where it's like, yes, she does have the power, but that power could easily be eliminated by just killing her, you know?
Well, not only that, it could easily be, I don't know. It could easily be, who wouldn't call the bluff? I mean, of somebody that, I'll kill all of us. Yeah, okay, I dare you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, but I don't want to pick, you know, just on that stuff, because I did like the way that it was paced, at least with the Philippa thing. I just thought there were better moments to resolve it. It's too much of a push, and it's one of those things where I'm very aware of the fact that, just like everything else, any sort of criticism that's offered can sometimes be taken a bit too hard. I, just recently, you know, with like The Last Jedi, I had significant issues with certain decisions that they made. And it eventually got to the point where it just wasn't worth even talking about anymore. And I'm not there with Discovery, but it very much tempers. Like, I think it squashes the urge to offer critique when you're in times like this where it it can be a flashpoint thing, but you know, I don't want to keep picking on the last episode because I pointed to it as some as one of the episodes I liked best of this entire series, and it remains that way. And you know, I can get over the Philippa thing, and you know, Laurel has the thing, and all of that stuff, but the thing I think that encapsulates the difficult split personality of the show, from my perspective, is the appearance of the 1701 at the very tail end of everything. This show, and the reason I dislike it, is because this show, finally by that episode, has made its declaration. This is what we are. We are different. We're our own thing. We don't need to rely on previously established canon. We can do our thing. We can make this work. Oh, by the way, here's the 1701. See you next time. And it's like, oh, you didn't need to do that, guys. Like, I mean, I saw that as the only way I can resolve it mentally is it. I mean, the unfortunate thing is it boxes them in. What happens at the beginning of the second season has to address this, even if you don't see it. And the only way I can resolve it mentally is that they didn't know if they were going to get a second season. And so this was their season two pitch to any fans who were passionate about the series. If CBS didn't decide to continue it, there would be enough fans to do the letter writing campaign again to say, no, we got to see them interact with the Enterprise. We got to see what's going on. And CBS saying, oh, shucks, fine, a second season. Like, that's the only way I can contextualize that and make it work in a real world sense for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm not that cynical about it. They did say flat out that was not part of the plan when Fuller was on board. That came later on. But I mean, you know, hearing them talk about it and their reasons for doing it, at least what they've said just like in the past 24 hours, you know, like talking about how it's the elephant in the room and everything, and talking about how, like, if you are going to set a show in this continuity, in this time period, you know, that is something which you can use, so why wouldn't you use it? And to me, I mean, I thought it was great because it's like, what are they planning on doing with it? How are they planning on doing it? And I think that is cool. I think there's nothing wrong with using that because, you know, otherwise you're going to be just dancing around it forever and there's going to be all these what ifs. And it's kind of like, well, why aren't you doing that? And you know, I don't think that the season's going to focus on it or whatever, although I'd be totally cool if it did. You know, but why not? You know, I think it's cool. I'm all for that stuff, but that's just me. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, it was a totally different sort of reaction than I guess it gets to sort of the thing that never really settled for me about the Mirror Universe being in the first season either, or for how long it was it is another. You know, like you said, people regard it as a crutch. I've never regarded the Mirror Universe as a crutch before, but I think that it's the type of thing where I would have liked to see it a little more earned, I guess. Not earned is the wrong word, but I just would have liked to see them take their time to get there. And in terms of dancing around it, I would have been fine with them dancing around it. I think if anything, I just think it has the, I guess I am just being too cynical. So whatever. That's me.
All right.
Years of TV watching have hardened this heart.
That's fair. Okay. So just, you know, as long as we're talking about things which, you know, may not have blown us away, what disappointed you the most about this show from a creator standpoint, you know, like with writers and directors, whether it's someone who you feel dropped the ball or someone who, you know, maybe didn't get to do what you were hoping they would do or whatever, or someone who, you know, they did bring on who you weren't particularly thrilled with? What writer were you most disappointed with? Not necessarily, you know, what were you most disappointed with in terms of the writers?
I would just say that it would just be a blanket nobody in specific sort of situation, but just the fact that it did do that thing which Star Trek has always been most criticized for, which is, we're in a hole. Let's throw this explanation, and if we use certain terminology, people can't call BS on it. They'll just say, well, yeah, okay, that's science. I don't like that.
Okay.
I know that Star Trek is known for it, and I know that I'm a big hypocrite because there are times in the past where I haven't liked it, but maybe it's just by this point. It's like I always think of the B plot, again, picking on Voyager, I guess, but the one where the Doctor gets his family, the Hala family, and it has like real tragedy. And like, it's a real terrific episode, but there's like some B plot to it that's like, oh, okay, guys, come on. And just, I guess, being in the Mirror Universe, just, I thought it was just too long, just took too much time there.
Okay. All right. I mean, for me, I mean, there's two things which, I don't know, maybe they're intertwined or not, I don't know. But, you know, on a smaller level, it's the fact that Nicholas Meyer didn't write one of these episodes.
Mm.
That's really disappointing to me. You know, I mean, they hyped that up so much that they put out a press release saying that he had joined the writing staff. And I remember, like, he did an interview, like, that day. And they're like, so what are you doing as a consulting producer? And he's like, I don't know. Hopefully I get to write some episodes. And he didn't, or maybe he did, and then they were tossed out or whatever. I mean, at one point they were saying that he wrote episode 2, but obviously that changed. So that, to me, was the biggest disappointment. But I guess that's kind of an extension of this idea that Brian Fuller didn't get to actually do his thing. And, yeah, you know, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm not saying that they made the wrong choice. I mean, obviously, you've got to get a show out. And it sounds like, you know, he had some trouble hitting deadlines. And obviously, as is evidenced by two shows which he's left since Discovery, he has trouble, you know, staying on a show. But just from a purely, you know, audience standpoint, I am very disappointed that we didn't get to see the show that he wanted to make, you know, not saying that it's would have been better or not, but I would have liked to have seen what that show was.
Yeah. I would too.
And as far as like directors are concerned or directing or anything?
I don't think there was anything disappointing. There wasn't anything where I was like, oh, I can't believe you made that decision. Or, you know what, though? I will speak to something that that you called out about the experience on Prime versus on CBS All Access about the frame rate.
Yeah.
Was until you said something, I remember looking at it, I was like, oh, geez, this just doesn't look right. And then you said that on CBS All Access, they're it's like 60 frames per second versus 24. And I actually want to go back and rewatch certain episodes at least, because that was one of the things that always drove me nuts during the fight scenes. I was like, wow, did they like open up the shutters? Like, well, wow, what's going on here? Like visually, it looked like, you know, like there was episode judder. There was visual judder to it. And I would love to go now and try it out on Amazon Prime just to see what those fight and quick camera movements looked like at the proper frame rate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was shot at 24 frames a second, obviously. And for some reason, CBS All Access is outputting at 60. And Amazon, the Amazon channel thing, is outputting at 24. And, you know, for some sets or whatever, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, there's a lot of TVs or monitors or whatever which can, you know, put it back to the way it should be, the 24, without any issue. But like mine has trouble with it, and because of that, you know, I tried out the Amazon channels thing instead of, you know, going straight to CBS All Access, and you know, it looked better. And also, I can't 100% confirm this because I don't have a 5.1 channel setup, but from what I can tell, the Amazon app outputs at 5.1 surround sound, whereas CBS only does 2-channel stereo. So if anyone is looking or whatever, or maybe you weren't sure or didn't think there was a difference or whatever, you know, doing a side-by-side test, you know, I can tell you that at least on my setup, everything seems to be better on Amazon instead of CBS. So, you know, take that as you will, I guess. Everyone who's not in America is like, these losers, you know, we're all just watching this on Netflix. It's all good, but whatever. Yeah. For me, I mean, the big, disappointment, which we didn't find out about until after the fact, was that, you know, one of Brian Fuller's choices to direct the pilot was Edgar Wright. And, you know, I mean, Edgar Wright has all sorts of pedigree, but now, especially after seeing Baby Driver, it's like, oh, God, that would have just been so cool to have his, you know, his directing touch on this show. But, you know, like I said, I think the direction on the show is really great. So, but still, you're like, what would that look like? What would, you know, Edgar Wright directed Star Trek be like? And, you know,
as cool as it would have been to see an Edgar Wright thing, I don't know how that would have played. Like, I think it would have been stylistically so divergent. Maybe part of Fuller's thinking was he was going to get in directors like that to direct everything so that each episode would have its own feel to it, in a sense. Who knows? But
I remember reading a rumor, and I forget where this came from, but someone was saying that basically Fuller was planning on sort of doing, well, they compared it to what like Stranger Things does in terms of like tapping into the sort of like aesthetic of the 60s, you know, in Stranger Things it's the 80s, but here it would be the aesthetic of the 60s, but with modern sensibilities. You know, the thing that I keep on thinking of is like what they did with X-Men Days of Future Past, where it feels like a 60s sci-fi movie because it takes place in the 60s, but, you know, with modern filmmaking techniques and everything. And I think that that would have been really cool, you know, but I guess it just wasn't meant to be. You know, not to take away from anything that was done here, you know, like I'm saying, but it's a very cool what if. Somewhere there's a vault with all of the material that Fuller had, you know, put together or whatever for this show, and one day that vault is going to open, and I cannot wait to see what's inside, you know?
Yeah, stay healthy, kids. That's going to be a good long ways down the road. One last thing I want to ask you about is in terms of the visual effects. There were moments where I thought the visual effects were just, you know, knock it out of the park, fantastic, loved them. I love the way they handled the holograms. I thought that I actually thought it was really cool that I think it's it's either the end of the first or the beginning of the second episode, Battle of the Binary Stars and everything, where the light sourcing was done to interact with Sarek's hologram. And I thought that was so neat. Like, it just looked great. And I liked the way that the holograms, I liked the way the heads-up displays were done. I liked all of that stuff. But there were moments where the effects just didn't play for me. Where, do you think that that's just an aspect of the production schedule? And I'm setting my expectation too high? Like, what was your overall impression?
Overall, I thought it was really good. You know, I think there was some weird, like, lighting choices on some of the models and everything like that, where it kind of looked mushy. But I think that was more of a stylistic choice than anything else. But for the most part, I thought that the effects were really cool. I mean, it's all about the spore jumps, right?
I did like that effect a lot. I really did. And I like the fact that when they would jump and they were either just over a planet surface or like when they were in the cave in the final one and you saw those thrusters fire to like, mm-hmm. I thought like that was cool. That's an example of something where I'm not really used to seeing that sort of thing in Star Trek. And so it took me off guard and I was like, oh, neat. I like that. You know, I like that type of stuff. I don't care how well the effect is done. If it's something that's really cool looking or different.
Yeah. All right, so just to wrap this up, I mean, any final thoughts on Discovery?
Yeah, I might not be the world's biggest fan of the show, but I didn't dislike it. I'm intrigued where they go with the second season. Will I be back for the second season? Honestly, it all depends. I guess this is the part where they do have the hard work of maybe being a little bit more transparent and talking about what they're going to do to maybe course correct some of the things that people like me weren't nuts about with season one.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Where do you fall?
On the whole, I mean, I really, really liked it. You know, I mean, I guess these are my two questions for the final thing. Here they are.
Okay.
All right. Where do you think this series falls in your personal rankings of Star Trek series?
Oh, I mean, Deep Space Nine it's always going to be my gold standard. And then I'm going to have Next Generation and then original series, probably tied with Enterprise. So, and then Voyager, and then adding in Discovery into that mix, I definitely liked it more than Voyager, and I probably liked it better than about a quarter to a third of Enterprise up to this point. So I guess I'd put it tied with the original series.
That's pretty good, tied with the original series.
It is, but like in a golf tie sort of thing, where it's like if you don't let me have two number threes, then it's a number four sort of thing, you know what I'm saying? Because like in golf, it's, you know, 1, 2, 3, 3, 3, 5 sort of thing.
Okay. All right.
The most important thing is that I know that there are Voyager fans that are like, come on, he can't put it above last. But sorry, guys, that's just.
Well, animated series.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I know last. Sorry. Yeah, but yes.
For me, I think overall, right now, I'd probably put it right below Deep Space Nine. You know, but because I mean, Deep Space Nine has, like you're saying, 7 years to build on or whatever. But I mean, you know, it's weird. Like, are the high points as high as the best of the original series or the best of Next Generation? Maybe not, but consistency goes a long way. So I guess that leads to the second question, you know, putting it on a bit more even ground. How do you feel that this stacks up to the other season ones?
To the other season ones, this actually doesn't, I mean, Voyager still at the bottom, and with the animated series, that's a given. Deep Space Nine had kind of a rough first season, with consistency. So, and then Next Generation was okay. So building from the bottom, I mean, yeah. first season of Next Generation, you know, it's so easy to forget because like you think of Next Generation, you're like, oh yeah, season 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. And then you think about season 1, you're like, boy, how did that show would have been canceled today. So you got down at the bottom, you got animated series and you got Voyager, then building up, you got, I'd actually give TNG's first season lower than Voyager.
Yeah,
honestly.
Me too.
Yeah, no doubt. And then, Deep Space Nine above Voyager, probably tied with Enterprise. So I would probably slot Discovery around the first season of Voyager in my rankings, like just as a golf tie again.
Okay. All right. I think for me, starting at the bottom, it would be animated series and then Next Gen and then probably Enterprise. And then, you know, we're going up now. Then we're getting into the territory where I think things get, you know, pretty good. Probably Voyager, then original series. See, original series is tough on any scale because you've got the absolute best and the absolute worst, you know, right next to each other there. And
yeah,
then,
that's true.
And then Deep Space Nine, I think I'd put it number one. I mean, Voyager season one was pretty solid too. But I think Deep Space Nine would definitely be number one as far as first seasons are concerned, aside from Discovery. I think that Discovery is undoubtedly the best first season of any Star Trek show.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't. How dare you have that opinion, Mike? Mike Schindler, after all these years of podcasting together and friendship, how can you possibly say that? No, that's cool.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Well, you know, it's been a fun journey here, going back to the very beginning when, you know, there was nothing but a few people sitting in an office to now, you know, here we are, the finished product is actually out there, you know, to the world, whatever, everyone can see it. And you know, it's been a lot of fun. I'm glad we did it. But that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
But let's start with that first one, that siege in superspace. So, oh boy. Superspace, I don't know, is this better than subspace? Is it...
The thing I really love about this issue is we haven't had many stories at all about superspace.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Right, so okay, they're under orders, they're not supposed to talk about it, and that's how you maintain the continuity that Kirk and Spock are surprised that there's a mirror universe. I mean, that works, that makes sense. But these people were there. They know that there's doppelgangers there, because they know that because Cadet Tilly became Captain Killy, right? They know this.
To the journey!
There was a lot of face melting in this episode, you're right.
Everyone's melting, what a world!
It was, yeah, and everybody was slimy looking. Why were they so sweaty? Why?
Seven of Nine had this full-on Borg Queen look about her.
She did, and who else was really sweaty looking besides Seven?
Neelix was really sweaty looking.
Yeah, well, yeah, I thought he was.
And he had kind of a silver tone. He had the silver blood.
He did. Like, he was distinguished. Distinguished melting Neelix. Yes.
Yeah, he got a buff and polish.
The 602 Club.
No, I mean, it was really all we had was like animated shows. Like, you had like the animated Batman series, the animated Superman series, and as far as the big screen went, it was not so great. I mean, you had Blade. Blade was, some people cite Blade as kind of the precursor for the superhero genre picking back up, but it was very much kind of a genre film. I know technically it is a comic book film. I don't know if I'd count it in the realm of, like, big-budget superhero movies.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone or iPad or Apple TV or the desktop iTunes app and get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and there are many ways for you to contact us. The best place is to join the larger conversation in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at trekfm. And on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me as Kessel Junkie out there. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. You can find me over on the Nerd Party, where I'm co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing and Great Shot Kid, a show of similar vein but broader scope than what we do here at Stage 9 with you, Mike Schindler.
Yeah, you can find me over there doing that show with you, and, you know, I'm nowhere else right now, but I will be at some point in the near future. I'm planning things.
He's going to open his own stereo store.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm going to call it Mike's Super Cool Stereo Store.
Yes.
You know, if you want to find out where that'll be, find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and, you know, there'll be some news in the not-too-distant future, I guess.
Yes.
We would like to thank our associate producers today, Chris Steftenagel, Norman C. Lau, and Jeff Sutter.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. We really appreciate all of your support since the very beginning. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network at Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right, 78 down and one to go.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week to wrap up this whole big thing.